Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Minorities often struggle to find proper treatment for mental illnesses. There are lots of reasons, but the bottom line is that when a person who needs help can't get it, mental illness can worsen and disable. Joining us now is the executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Ohio. It's a grassroots mental health organization. Terry Russell, welcome.
Thank you for having me back.
And joining us by phone is associate professor of sociology and criminal studies and creator and coordinator of criminal studies program at Salem College, Kimya Dennis. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kimya, if you had to say one kind of starting point for this discussion, would it be the issues of the taboo issues inside the minority communities, or would it be something external?
It's both. It's a combination of both.
Okay.
And so there are cultural issues in terms of the falsely held belief that mental health and suicidal behaviors did not exist before transatlantic slavery happened. So there's this false notion that suicide and mental health is a relatively new issue in African diaspora cultures around the world. And also a huge problem that I'm doing work on is that mainstream mental health and suicide organizations, the majority of these organizations, do not address demographic and cultural variance.
How so? Why?
Why? Because these are organizations that are predominantly white, and it's this false notion that the DSM and that mental health and suicide in general are objective and culturally neutral topics that can be discussed and that can reach any audience anywhere regardless of the culture. And so that's one thing that I challenge, because I want all people to know and all organizations to know that we have to do annual assessments to look at the demographics of these organizations and also the demographics of the audiences that they reach. We cannot assume that we're reaching the broad audience. And people have to be honest that if the organization is not reaching the broad audience, there are communities that are not being reached, and it's not always the community's fault.
Terry Russell, what about that? Talk about NAMI and how it reflects this issue.
Absolutely. I totally agree that our mental health system, like all other systems, I don't think it's just ours, feel very uncomfortable talking about the disparity between how those in the white community and those in the black community are treated within our system. There is little doubt that if you look out, that few minorities are in our mental health system. About 2% of the professionals, the trained professionals, are black individuals, and therefore not as welcoming, not as open to minorities as we should be. And not talking about that because it's uncomfortable.
Why is it uncomfortable?
I don't know why. I really don't. I've been in the business a long time, but when I look at I don't see racism within the system or individuals, but I do say an institutional racism that says that we need to or we do not open ourselves up to those who are in the most need. It's uncomfortable. We feel more comfortable serving those who are more like us, who are have the wealth or middle class or something. It's the people that are really hurting in this society. It's just a terrible situation. Let's take homelessness.
Right.
In Columbus, Ohio, about 22% of the population is black. If you look at the population of homelessness, especially for those 18 to 24, it's 76% are minorities. Well, why is that? I mean, what's the answer to that? Mm-hmm. And when I look at the mentally ill in the homeless population, which is about 40% at least, then we're doing something wrong, not bringing in people and getting the care they need early. It appears to me, and I work a lot with housing, is that before minorities get into the mental health system, it's too late, and they end up out in harm's way. And that's when we rally around and try to do something, that's too late.
When it's critical.
When it's critical, right.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're drilling down into the issue of minority mental health care for people who are racial or ethnic minorities in the United States. If you have a question or comment coming up later in the program, we'd like to hear from you. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard from Terry Russell. He's a executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Ohio. Also with us by phone, Kimia Dennis. She's an associate professor of sociology and criminal studies and creator and coordinator of the criminal studies program at Salem College. Kimia, is a lot of this just a dearth of research is part of the problem?
No, we have actually a lot more research over the last 20 years.
Okay.
And NAMI is amazing because on their website, you can get linked to a lot of the research, and that includes links on NAMI's website where it will allow you to click and you can look up information about African-American mental health and suicide and American Indian, Alaskan Native. But the issue is, like he referenced, which is it's this discomfort. And, for example, whenever I work with organizations that address mental health and suicide prevention, the moment you mention cultural variations, whether it's addressing how the opioid crisis has been a crisis for some cultures for decades now, the moment you mention that, some people start to sweat. And that's a power dynamic as well. What it means when there are powerful groups who are very represented, for example, whites are over 60% of the U.S. population, and that's represented in all mental health suicide prevention organizations, which is why minority groups tend to create our own organizations. So, for example, you have the Black Mental Health Alliance based in Baltimore, Maryland. But one thing that I want people to do is to, it's understandable to create our own groups, but we also have to stay within the mainstream groups so that we can both encourage and challenge these mainstream groups to stop pretending to be culturally neutral and objective. For example, stop pretending the DSM is something that's universally applicable. We have to...
The DSM being that score kind of the official descriptions of mental illness,
yeah.
And that kind of a thing, yeah.
Yes, because that has changed over the generations, and it still needs to be updated to address that different factors can be expressed different across different cultures because people are taught different ways, they learn in different ways, they express that in different ways. And so, and like he was saying, there is this level of unease there. And when I talk about racism, I don't call individuals racist. Mm-hmm. Instead, I do what he did, which is talk about institutional dynamics. So the racism is a structural institutional component because it's based on this notion that whites are the researchers, particularly white men.
So the implicit bias or the...
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And the assumption, this is the assumption that's always existed in research across all disciplines, was that white men are the researchers. It used to only be white men as the respondents. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that this finding applies to everyone. And that's still being applied to mental health and suicide organizations and practitioners, psychologists, psychiatrists, most of whom are not trained in cultural knowledge, cultural awareness, cultural outreach, and people wait until diversity trainings. And I tell people, diversity is 365 days a year, right? It has to be incorporated in everything you learn in school, everything you do as an organization, because waiting for a training or waiting for a special event is insulting because it implies that all these groups that are in dire need of help can wait until your organization feels the need to address the issue.
Give us an example of what that training you say should be incorporated at the very beginning of a professional's education and career. What would it be?
Okay, so the work I'm doing now is I am trying to reach different undergraduate and graduate programs that are teaching people to be counselors, therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, because all of my work is interdisciplinary, and I want everyone to be trained how to go beyond their discipline and see what other disciplines are saying, because it's usually the same thing with different theories and different wording. But I also want all schools to look at how all of their courses need to delve further into addressing demographics. So, for instance, let's say there is a graduate-level course that is teaching about family therapy. 99% of these courses are claiming that there's one type of family, right? The idea of the two-parent household is still operating in many places.
Right.
But even if they delve into the single-parent household, they're still based on this idea that family means having children. And to go further than that, it's also implying that there's just one way of operating as a family. Whereas instead, there are different cultures in which family means something different. So, for example, in African-American families, there's different perceptions in what corporal punishment means. And there are African-Americans, if you tell them they can't spank their child, they will say, you don't understand our culture. That's debatable, of course. Mm-hmm. However, what we need to do is study what that means, because we don't have to judge something and say you're doing this wrong in order to understand it. And I think that's a huge problem when we're talking about education programs, because people can graduate with, you know, doctorates in psychology, even medical degrees, and when they have patients of different cultures, they have no idea how to address that, because as far as they're concerned, they're going literally based on what they were taught, which is diabetes type 2, this is what it is, this is how it impacts everyone. You know, schizophrenia, this is what it is, this is how it impacts everyone. So the work that I'm doing now, I want to challenge schools to look at how every single one of their courses includes a diversity component, which includes sexual identity and gender identity.
It sounds like they don't even know what they don't know.
They don't even know what they don't know, and people can oftentimes get annoyed and irate because it can come across as insulting to their discipline. It comes across as insulting to the research conducted. It comes across also as making something more complex than necessary. I've been told over the years that I'm complicating something.
Huh.
Someone told me in a mental health organization that whites have the highest rate of suicide, therefore, why does it matter if an audience is all white? And that's when I tell people I also do work to address how we can redefine suicidal ideation, suicidal self-harm, because that can include things such as black men ages 15 to 34, the number one cause of death is homicide, right? So what I'm trying to delve further into is saying, can this include suicidal behavior? For mm-hmm. example, what does it mean when people go into potentially deadly environments knowing that they probably might die and maybe hoping they will die? And instead of putting that in the homicide category and calling people criminals and hoodlums, let's look at suicidal ideation. And that's an example of how we need to expand this, not only in our communities need to expand this, but also we need organizations to understand this and to not get outraged when those of us who do try to delve further are challenging organizations to do so. We're not doing so to insult organizations. We're doing so because there are millions of people who need to be reached, and that's not possible if people think there's no issue in the first place.
Terry Russell, does this sound familiar as far as what you hear from people sometimes saying, oh, it's everything complicated enough. We have to put another layer of complication on it.
Yeah, that's part of the reason we don't communicate. You asked earlier why mm-hmm. we don't communicate, because it is uncomfortable. Let me also say, though, I want to make something clear. This isn't just the behavioral health system. We have to look at how our society reacts,
yeah.
and especially in areas that impact the minority community and housing, criminal justice, health care. All of those areas, I think, have the same problems. And we need to educate everybody, because this isn't going to be solved by the behavioral health system.
You can't compartmentalize it.
Absolutely. And if we do, even if we succeed, we've still, the people we work with, you know, I my major priority probably in the mental health system here in Ohio is housing.
Huh.
And that has a major impact on all of our minority communities. And they're overrepresented in, again, the most confined programs we have. We need to people early identification and then get that person into treatment, because treatment works. If a person can get into treatment and that it can work, and if they, it is cultural competency evolved. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, what we're seeing now is, especially in the Black community, the overrepresentation in the most encompassing programs, such as inpatient service, residential services for kids, our criminal justice system is we should all be ashamed that we have so many people walking the streets with a mental illness who are minorities, who are there because there's no services for them or competent services for them.
We'll continue our conversation. We're talking about, as Terry Russell, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Ohio, just said, you know, the lack of services, the lack of competency in services when it comes to mental health services for people who are ethnic and racial minorities in the United States. Also with us, Kimya Dennis. She's an Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Studies and Creator and Coordinator of Criminal Studies of the Criminal Studies Program at Salem College. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the disparities between white majority and racial and ethnic minorities when it comes to mental health care in the U.S. Still with us is the Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Ohio, Terry Russell, and by phone, Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Studies and the Creator and Coordinator of the Criminal Studies Program at Salem College, Kimya Dennis. Joining us now by phone is the Director of Clinical and Health Services Research at the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities, Dr. Regina James. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
The existing disparities probably don't surprise you. In 1999, the Surgeon General put out a report that said disparities lie in the availability, accessibility, and quality of mental health services for racial and ethnic minorities. What's changed since then?
Well, actually, there's been another, I think, landmark report that was put out after the report by Dr. Satcher, which I think you're referring to, the Unequal Treatment Confronting Racial and Ethnic Disparities in Healthcare, and that was released actually in 2002, again, underscoring the lower quality of healthcare that not only impacts minority populations, but populations in general. So there have been a number, I think, of efforts on different fronts to try to address these disparities. And again, I can speak to it from a research perspective, but there have been a number of avenues that have been addressed to make sure that we can get a handle on this.
So back in 1999, in that same report, the Surgeon General said that research was needed to get information about prevention, access, service delivery, quality of care, and so forth. What kind of research has been done since then?
So here at the National Institutes of Health, there are 27 institutes and centers, and I think the institute that specifically focuses on mental health, obviously, is the National Institute on Mental Health, and they actually have a strategic plan and a large research portfolio around addressing mental health disparities. Here at the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities in our Health Services Research Division, we also support a large number of research programs looking at healthcare disparities as it relates to access to care, care coordination, quality of care, insurance coverage, et cetera. So these are ongoing projects that are trying to address and help us provide some fund of knowledge of how to get our head around this important problem.
Yeah, it's the get our head around it, right? First of all, it's hard to quantify in some way, isn't it?
Well, I think we all know that it exists. And I think what research can do is really to provide the data, to provide the foundation so that we can build upon how can we address this in a systematic way.
Kimya, what let's talk about why minorities don't seek treatment at all sometimes. They just avoid it until it becomes too critical of a problem, as Terry Russell mentioned earlier, and then there's a really big issue. What are the built-in issues before treatment is ever even sought?
So it's as with many things, there are many components of this. So one component is this: what people are taught all their lives, which is this is a white people's problem, and it's not people of African descent's issue. Also, this false notion that mental health conditions and suicidal ideation are not something that exist on the continent of Africa, or at least did not exist before transatlantic slavery. So this is something that's still holding strong. Every generation, people are teaching it to children, people are saying it at schools, people are saying it in college.
Why would that emerge as a thing ever? Why was it ever considered an accurate portrayal of the situation?
Well, it's based on this issue of tautology. It's a tautological argument. When we think about oppression and what it means when you have cultures in which self-identity and cultural identity are centered around being an oppressed people, like I tell my students, you have to stand beyond that. You never want your cultural identity and self-identity to be based on oppression. But that's easier said than done, especially with more and more research addressing how poverty and the conditions in many African-American communities can result in PTSD. There's newer research to address that, and that can be critiqued as well. But that's a component of this. So when we do presentations in African diaspora communities, mm-hmm. there are people who are skeptical because they feel as though there's one more thing that they're being told is wrong with them, as though they're not being told enough things are wrong with them. Also, there are people who believe that we're falling for some kind of trick from whites to convince non-whites that this is an issue among non-whites. And people will quote data. They'll say, we have the lowest suicide rate. And I've even had mental health practitioners who are white tell me that we need to follow the model that black women use because black women are so strong and have the lowest suicide rate. And I say, stop using the phrase strong black women, first of all. Mm-hmm. But also, having the lower suicide rate does not mean you have the lower suicidal ideation. There's a difference there. Mm-hmm. Also, I'm sorry.
No, why is there a difference? I mean, what do you mean by that?
So we can't read people's minds. So there are people who are thinking about all sorts of things, but they may attempt suicide or they may never complete a suicide. And the data that we have on suicide, it's just like when we talk about crime data. There's a dark figure, meaning difference between what's reported and what's actually happening. And that's also reflected when we talk about the quote-unquote strong black women. You don't know what these African diaspora women are thinking and feeling. And also, there are African diaspora women who are going through depression, who have extreme anxiety, and they'll tell you the only thing that keeps them going is their children or belief in God, for example. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that's also prevalent in African diaspora communities, religiosity. However, I consider that unhealthy because that's oftentimes used to hide what's happening to people. And most religious institutions, whether it's Christianity, Islam, are not in this environment conducive to people talking about their issues without being told, well, pray about it, or God's going to take care of it. And another issue that's happening in African diaspora communities that reduces the likelihood that people will seek treatment: transportation issues. We have most cities, the public transportation is having problems, and most mental health facilities are not within walking distance of many of these communities. And even when people have transportation, sometimes people are apprehensive because, number one, they know they're going to a facility where the people in the facility are not culturally conscious. So telling the people in that facility anything could come across as you having a mental health condition because the people in the facility don't understand cultural variance in behaviors and personality types, perhaps. And also, there are people of African descent who are skeptical about going to a therapist who is also of African diaspora. And that's because in most cities, there's a very small population of African-American professionals. So that increases the likelihood that if you go to an African-American counselor, you might know that person. The person might belong to your church.
Yeah.
The person might know someone you know. And it's good to trust people to be professional, but there are people in African-American communities who are skeptical. They're wondering, can I really share all this information with you in such a small African-American population in the city without it ending up being told to somebody else?
Dr. Regina James, is there a way to measure what the larger societal costs are of failing to meet the needs of racial and ethnic minorities when it comes to mental health issues?
Well, it's actually interesting that you asked that question. I know that there was a study done a number of years ago by Tom LaViste and his colleagues that actually looked at sort of the economic burden of health disparities. So they actually did try to quantify how this actually impacts not only minority communities, but the community at large. And they actually did find that there was a financial or an economic burden. There were excess costs due to direct medical costs as it relates to health inequity. So there is sort of this economic burden related to health disparities, whether it be in mental health disparities or just health disparities in general.
Michael in Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yes, my question is to Mr. Russell. What is being done to weed out doctors and staff and employers with racist biases? The way services are delivered are often offending to us as a cultural.
Well, as I said earlier, there is absolutely no doubt that in our society, and especially in the behavioral health system, that there's cultural racism involved. And what we need to do is identify that. And what happens right now, nothing happens to those individuals because we don't talk about it. I would hope a show like this and more communications from people asking questions like you're doing would make the system more appropriate and more welcoming to everybody. And the only way to do that is identify it. But people just, their defenses go up the minute that you bring that up. If you ask that to the director of one of our community mental health centers, they would say, it's not true what you're saying. I personally have seen it enough that I know that it is. So the only way I know is education.
And educating, Dr. Regina James, both the providers and the community at large?
Oh, actually, yeah, most definitely. Not only educating, but, you know, in general, increasing public awareness to both the public and the providers is just one way to really address, you know, these barriers as it relates to addressing health disparities. And, of course, improving our knowledge base, right, with research, looking at the causes and potential interventions to decrease disparities. And it also goes without saying expanding health insurance, improving the number of physicians who actually provide services to underserved communities, and as has been mentioned this morning on a number of occasions, really strengthening communication between patients and physicians as it particularly relates to cultural competence and linguistic competence.
Yeah, Terry Russell?
Yeah, one of the things I want to make all the listeners understand, even with all the research we're talking about and the reality of not as welcoming we should be, people listening to this that need care should go seek it because treatment works, and without treatment, the consequences are devastating. So for all the listeners, whether you're African-American, whether you're white, whatever your ethnic condition, what we need is you to seek treatment. Now, let's fix the system within. I work for those living with mental illness and their families. And we love research. We want as much training as we can get. But what we want is our loved one to be well, That's what we're asking for. And we know that that's not going to happen if people do not seek the treatment they deserve.
Yeah. Right? Michael, thank you for your call. What do we know about... well, maybe I'll have Tia come on. Tia in Columbus, you're on the air. Go ahead, Tia. You're kind of getting at what I was going to bring up.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking, well, for me, I suffer from major depression disorder, and it's always been like a touchy topic with family members. And a lot of times I feel like if I make it too much of an issue, people will count me out as a good mom or a good wife or whatever, but I'm really seriously struggling, and I feel like, you know, my issues are falling on deaf ears because I come from a very religious background. My husband and I are both Christians, and a lot of times when I go through these periods, what I call like my my well moment, where I feel like I'm like just down in a dark well by myself, you know, I'll express that, and it seems like I get kind of attacked, like you need to be grateful. And you don't have anything to be depressed about. But I've had a very difficult childhood. My mom's a domestic violence survivor. And, of course, that means that I was around and I witnessed a lot of it. Mm-hmm. Even though I don't have any vivid memories of it because of my age when everything really got bad and we were separated from it, it has affected me throughout my life. Mm-hmm. And I
have you sought treatment, Tia?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
I have on several occasions. A lot of times I stop because of one reason or another, whether it's childcare issues or, you know, I had some medication that didn't really, it made me feel like I was kind of intoxicated.
Yeah.
And I didn't like that feeling. Instead of going back and getting like my prescription changed, I made that the excuse to stop using the therapy. And, you know, I stopped going for years after that.
Are you African-American?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I don't want to interrupt you. I appreciate your call. Kimya Dennis, it sounds familiar.
Yes, it's extremely familiar and unfortunate, but it's something that is going to keep happening because cultures are teaching this from generation to generation. So even when we do community programs, and even sometimes practitioners who get trained in cultural consciousness, what people do when they're at work is different than what they do when they're among their family members.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes you'll talk to African-American health experts, and they know the data, they know what they've been trained in, but when they go home, culture takes over. And what people are learning and are taught. And this is throughout every institution, family. In some school systems, it's like that. And when they go to church, it's like that as well. And so it's easy, theoretically, for us to tell people, go get treatment. I always tell people, go to your doctor. However, we have to go beyond saying that. Because what happens when we say that is, it solidifies the mainstream organizations who feel like that's a check off their list of to-do. Like when we say, just go to a mental health facility, there are mental health facilities who will feel like, okay, mission accomplished. They're telling people to come to us. And then the facilities themselves don't challenge themselves to be culturally conscious.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tia, thank you for your call. Best wishes. I just really appreciate your insights. Dr. Regina James, we have to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Before I go, I just wanted to highlight something that the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities has, in particular, in relation to African-Americans struggling with mental illness. We have when we talk about public awareness, we have a initiative called Brother, You're on My Mind. And if you'd go on the website, it actually has a toolkit. And I really encourage the public as well as folks in academia to really go online and see. When we talk about our African-American men, I think we haven't even brought up that.
Yeah, exactly. We haven't even gotten to that yet, right?
Yes. So before I leave, I just wanted to highlight and give some shout out to this initiative that I think is very important, and again has a toolkit that I think will be very, very helpful. So thank you for having me, and I appreciate this show, and I think it's a very, very, very important topic. So thank you for allowing me to participate.
Thank you. Dr. Regina James is the Director of Clinical and Health Services Research at the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities. We'll continue our conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about the disparities that exist for racial and ethnic minorities when it comes to getting needed mental health care. Still with us is the Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Ohio, Terry Russell, and by phone, Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Studies and the Creator and Coordinator of Criminal Studies Program at Salem College, Kimya Dennis. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kimya, can we talk a little bit more about African-American males and what's going on that with that? We don't want to end the show without focusing a little bit on that.
So with African-American men, as I mentioned earlier, for males in general, the number one cause of death, 15 to 34, is homicide, and suicide is a little bit further down. And on one end, I do research on African-American men's experiences, and I do this because we have this issue of male privilege, male dominance, patriarchy, that has a different effect on people of African diaspora, and many African diaspora men claim that they do not benefit from male privilege and male dominance. So the work that I do addresses how hegemonic masculinity can influence mental health for African diaspora males. Hmm. So what it means when they are told that being emotional makes you a punk. And so when I do work in mental health, I'm addressing emotions. I tell people talking about mental health does not mean that everyone in this discussion has a diagnosable condition. Instead, we're talking about what it means to have feelings, what it means to have emotions, and what it means to be in environments where that are conducive to expressing that. And so for African American boys and men, most are not in environments where they're able to be close to each other physically or emotionally, and it's difficult for African American men to even do things like get prostate cancer screenings. So when organizations do prostate cancer programs, it's usually only African American women in the audience. The men are not in the audience, and that's based on a number of fears, including fears that addressing health issues challenges your manhood and masculinity. And so I think this is important to assess, because we're not saying that African-American boys and men have more issues than girls and women of African descent, mm-hmm. but we're saying that there's a difference there. And so that's why when we do community programs to address African diaspora mental health and suicide, we want people to understand that we are not monolithic in terms of all people of African descent having the same thoughts, beliefs, and cultures. There are cultural variations, mm-hmm. and there are also different cultural power dynamics. So, for example, when reaching African American boys and men, it's difficult to talk about, like I said earlier, patriarchy and male privilege. So, for example, all religious institutions are dominated by men, for example. Mm-hmm. So since that's a difficult topic to discuss, I usually put that on the back burner. And instead of talking about power and privilege and how that can have a negative impact on seeking mental health treatment, I say, well, tell me, what are your experiences? How do you feel about your health? And many boys and men will just say that they're blessed and that everything's wonderful. But I do get a few men who are actually happy to have a non-judgmental place where they can just share their mental health condition. And they can talk about tremendous sadness, depression, anxiety. I had an African-American man tell me when I did a presentation this week that he has been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And he's becoming more and more comfortable discussing that because that's not something to which he should be ashamed. And so when we talk about African-American boys and men, I always want to highlight the complexity includes being taught all their lives, most of these men being taught all their lives, that you should never admit to feeling anything that might be negative, according to other people.
God, what stress. Allison in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Allison.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
You bet.
I just had a quick question. I am a high school teacher in a Columbus school district that has a really high population of minority students, including a very large Nepali community. And one thing we've talked a little bit in this discussion about getting education for students and community members at the collegiate level. And I'm very confused as to why I don't see much of that education going on at the high school level. Just this semester, I have had, and the semester started in January, I've had three students who came to me with suicidal ideation or attempts. And now only one of those was of a minority. And I understand that, you know, maybe there's a difference there in reporting or something like that, but I would be shocked in our massive community if there was nothing there, and that ratio of the 2-to-1 is what is present.
So you're thinking that it's only one, you're thinking there's probably many more, they're just not reporting it.
Well, yeah, and within our Nepali community, I've heard about them within the community from our students, but not from our student body.
Gotcha. Kimya Dennis?
Mm-hmm.
What about reaching out at early as high school, talking with people about these issues?
It needs to start in elementary school.
Hmm.
And the issue, though, with it starting in elementary school is you'll have to, of course, get parental approval, and you also have to be prepared for parents who will not approve. Because even when I do this work at the college level, there are parents who are like, oh, we don't have that problem. So they're speaking on behalf of the entire family as though they know the thoughts and feelings of everyone in the family, which is not possible, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe it needs to start in elementary school. You need to have an environment where kids are able to learn themselves. I mean, let's be honest. Most adults don't know their own personality and their own preferences. If you ask them to tell you about themselves, they can tell you about their family and what they were taught in school, but they were never taught to know themselves. And that increases as people get older. And that starts the moment people are born, and it, you know, increases in elementary school, middle school, high school. And so that's why I want, as early as elementary school, for children to be in an environment where they can talk and they're not just told to be quiet. They're not just told there's only one way to be a person. And they're also told that it's okay to have negative feelings and to come talk to somebody about those feelings. And it doesn't have to be presented as a mental health counselor. It can be presented as an open environment where it's someone who, if you're feeling some kind of way, we can discuss this. And I think that's something important for schools to discuss. And also when we're talking about cultural variations in terms of different groups who will express this different. We know that boys are often taught to express their anger through aggression, and the aggression can be expressed on themselves or on other people. And girls are taught the opposite, but that's not inherent. It's not based on genetics or hormones, for example. It's based on what boys and girls are taught. And so starting at elementary school, if teachers, principals, and counselors want children across cultures to feel comfortable talking to people, you also have to have people within those powerful groups, like teachers, who look like them. You can't expect, for example, Hispanic students, Asian students, African-American students, East Indian students, American Indian students to want to run to white teachers and say, here's what's going on in my life. Here's mm-hmm. what's happening to my family. That's just historically and contemporarily unrealistic to expect kids to want to talk to someone who they assume will have no way to relate to what's happening to them.
And Terry Russell, you're talking about bringing programs into churches too, another way to reach people where they live.
Right. The caller we just had, obviously Allison, the family is uneducated about...
You mean
Tia.
Yeah, okay.
About the uneducated about mental illness. And we have tried and tried to develop every kind of educational program we can for families to understand. I talked to an inmate up at Women's Correctional Facility in Marysville, an African-American young lady. She says, please talk to my family before I go home because they just think I'm crazy. And if we can work together, my family and I, I'll never come back here. And I think that was just an example of the beg of the family to be part of the treatment, mm-hmm. Not just some outsiders, as we say. I do want to speak also to the teachers.
Mm-hmm. Allison.
We're going through a tough time in education today with all the critical or the shootings, et cetera, et cetera. And there's been identification as the guns, is it mental health? There is no doubt that kids today with mental health problems aren't getting the treatment they need. It's less than 25% of children with a diagnosable mental health get any care at all. And so teachers are saying to us, we have to teach kids to pass tests. We don't have a minute of time mm-hmm. to deal with that. So NAMI is urging someone to be in the school, early identification of a troubled child, and early identification to make sure that that child is identified. I mean, we didn't identify the kid in Florida. All they did was expel him and say, don't bring your backpack or mm-hmm. your backpack with you. We can do better than that. And having someone at the school, this really isn't on our topic today, but having someone at school that can identify a child, and more importantly, after they identify, have a place where that person can go,
you know,
that kid could go.
We're just about out of time, but Kimya, Dennis, kids are a certain kind of minority, right?
Kids are a minority in terms of being children who don't have the same voice and access to resources.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't consider them a power minority in the larger sense that we use the phrase power minority. Because that can be problematic in terms of making power minority more of a catchphrase. But we do want children to have a voice, and we do want there to be adults present who can help the children without telling the children be quiet, without telling children you don't understand, you're just a child.
Mm-hmm.
So that's true. And so that's why we need all social institutions, family, schools, religious institutions, employment places as people get older and are able to find a job to understand what's happening here. I mean, people need to have that balance and they need to have access to resources. And that includes resources that they can afford. We also have to address the affordability issues.
Well, Kimya, Dennis, there's not enough time to get to all of that today. We'll continue our conversation in the future. I want to thank you for returning to the show to talk about this again.
Thank you for having me.
Kimya Dennis is an associate professor of sociology and criminal studies and creator and coordinator of the criminal studies program at Salem College. Also, Terry Russell, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Love to be here.
Terry Russell, executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Ohio. The Brother, You're On My Mind toolkit from the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities provides materials needed to educate community members on depression and stress in African-American men. We'll have a link to that at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.